Good morning. I'm Marcia Rising, and I currently am a very long-time member of the church since 1966, I realize, suddenly. And I'm also one of your lay ministers. And I would like to invite everybody to coffee hour in the fellowship hall after the service. And to get there, go through the church door to my left and follow the hallway to the end. There's an elevator or stairs which will take you down to the fellowship hall. We have child care that's available during this service in the nursery. If your need arises any time during the service, please feel free to take your child there where they'll be well cared for. And the nursery is located in the lower level of our fellowship hall. Again, you may go out the door down the hall, and if you need help, an usher will get you there. And if this is your first time with us, we're very happy to have you here. Please sign one of our guest books, which are located in the vestibule at the front of the church or at the visitor's table at coffee hour, so we can put you on our mailing list for our newsletters and announcements.
Let us come together in the spirit of worship with these words from William F. Schultz. Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power and let its vision change your heart. And Mike is going to light our chalice this morning. We light our chalice today for the history of this church, that its flame shines brightly, for the future of our faith, that the fire of commitment infuses us, and for this moment as we stand as a beacon to all who will join with us in this free faith. Our opening hymn is number 114, Forward Through the Ages. We're going to sing just the first and last verse of this. Please stand in body or in spirit. please join in our covenant and affirmation. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
From all that dwell below the skies, let words of love and peace arise. Let joyful songs of praise be sung through every land by every tongue.
Now I need three volunteers for my message for all ages today. Anyone up there willing to come help me? All right, come on down. Who else?
Oh, Emmett, come
on down. Okay, two, three. All right, great. Fabulous. Come on down. Thank you. I'm going to explain what's happening as they come down the stairs. We're going to be playing Monopoly. But that's a really long, long game. So I've shortened it up a bit, and we've changed the rules. I've found some new rules from a website called that some of you may be familiar with called Teaching Tolerance. This is called The Real Monopoly. And so it's a little bit different. This is a little bit different type of Monopoly. One of you is going to be the top hat and one the horse and one the shoe.
Who wants?
Horse, shoe, top hat. You can just tape those to yourselves there. All righty. Now, you all get $200. These $2 junior Monopoly bills signify $200 to start the game. There you go. You're all rich. Now, top hat, you're just going to play the game like usual. You can buy property. Every turn, you're going to get $200 for pass and go. And just play like normal. Now, horse. Things are a little different for you. You can go collect $200 each round, and you can also buy property. But after the fourth round, you have to give everything you own except for $200 to the top hat. Yeah. Shoe. Horse. Horseshoe. You can't buy property. You can't buy property, and you can only have $200 at a time. So anytime you get more than $200, I suggest, because you have no bank account, you're just going to give that money to the top hat. Okay? So here we go. Round two. $200. $200. Oh, wait. You got to give that to the top hat. You want to buy some property? Okay. All property costs $200. How many would you like? Okay. There you go. Would you like to buy some property? You're going to end up with $200. Do you want to buy property or not? It doesn't matter. Go ahead.
After 4 rounds, I get your property.
After 4 rounds, she gets everything but $200 from top hat. All right. You own what? Yes. Round three. Here we go. $200. $200. Yeah, it goes to the top hat. You want to buy some property, top hat?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're pretty snazzy. Here you go. Give me $200 for that one. Okay. There you go. Horse, would you like to buy some property?
No.
No? Okay.
You're good.
All right, $200. $200. $200. Oh, wait, you got to give it to the top hat. Right. Oh, okay. Yeah, not how banking works. So, top hat, you want to buy some property? Okay. Horse, you want to buy some property? Okay, here you go. You're hiding your money. Good strategy. Okay, this is round four. 200. I think this is round four. 200. You can give it your stupid self. There you go. Okay. Oh, wait, now, horse, it's time. It's time, horse. Your life has changed. The rules have changed for you now, horse. You must give everything except for $200 to the top hat. There you go.
for the better again. You get to keep this. You want to buy some property?
No.
Okay. And you want to give that away? All right, so that was five rounds. Now, at this point, things change. And if we were going to keep playing, which we're not, everybody could buy property and keep money. And you could buy it from each other. But we're going to just pass this off to the next generation of players, and they're going to pick up where you left off. Okay. So who's the winner right now?
Top hat.
Yeah. Right. And are there people in history who like the shoe? Like the shoe, some people were never allowed to own property in our country's early history, right? Yes. Who? African Americans? Women? Yeah. Native Americans. And like the horse, there were some people who had property, but that property was taken from them, right? Like Native Americans in particular? Yeah. And then we reset the rules. We reset the rules like we just did right now. Everybody's allowed to own property. Everybody's allowed to have money. And that's really fair, right?
No,
she still has all the property and the money. So how can we make this monopoly more fair? Hey, Top Hat, what can we do to make things more fair?
Not making it a rich white man.
Are you going to give away some of that? Communism? All right. There we go.
Here. She needs a lot of money.
All right, reparations. We may not be able to fix the world, but it looks like we can fix church monopoly. Thank you all for your help. Thank you, Top Hat. Thank you, Boyce. Thank you, Drew.
So during Black History Month, the month of February, our church is joining with UU churches in Concord and Sudbury in reading the names of lynching victims in the U.S. Our church has agreed to read 100 names over the two services this month. The point of this observance is to honor the memory of those whose lives were so unfairly cut short, as well as to encourage us to be aware of racial violence that still exists in our communities, our nation, and our world. And our opportunity and responsibility to be the change we want to see in the world. There's an insert in your bulletin that shares more about this observance and the names that we will be reading each Sunday. We have done this in a way to be accountable to people of color by receiving counsel from Black Lives UU, which is the organization we share our plate with today. As we enter into a time of reverent observance and listening to the names that are read, I offer this quote from the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. For the hanged and beaten, for the shot, drowned, and burned, for the tortured, tormented, and terrorized, for those abandoned by the rule of law, we will remember. With hope, because hopelessness is the enemy of justice. With courage, because peace requires bravery. With persistence, because justice is a constant struggle. With faith, because we shall overcome. And now I invite forward from our Racial Justice Task Force, June McKnight, to read the names.
Joseph Allen, William Owens, Martin Love, William Moore, George Herbert, Samuel Bland. On July 28, 1880, Millie Johnson, aged between 20 and 30, and Bob Thompson, aged 16, were shot in Clayton, Georgia, for testifying against a white planter in an assault case. Abe Twiggs, Mary Turner, Hayes Turner, on July 11th, 1900, Rennie Jefferson, aged 22, was hanged after being found under the home of his employer, a prominent white farmer. Richard Young, Brown, Washington.
Let us take a moment of silence as we honor these and all the hundreds and thousands more. These words are by Marta Flanagan. God of all generations, in all the power, mystery, and design of this world, draw us near. Inspire us to see in you the life before us. Make us like the child who sees so clearly and touches so deeply. From the source of our being, we yearn for new vision, new eyes to see the world, new ears to hear the cries of sorrow and joy. Uplift us to the glories beheld in ourselves and those around us. And yes, open our hearts to the pain we guard within ourselves and to the pain known by so many in body and in spirit. In this moment of life, sustain us in the silence of our thoughts and prayers. Peace be to this congregation. Peace be to all. Amen. John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, was a sailor involved in the slave trade when the ship he was on went through a violent storm, and he tossed himself to the ship's pump to avoid being overthrown, tossed overboard like had happened to a crewmate beside him. While in that storm, he had a conversion moment. And sometimes we think of that as the moment at which he completely left the slave trade and wrote Amazing Grace, but that's not what happened. He continued to work on and then captain a slave ship, although eventually he did become an abolitionist. And eventually he did write Amazing Grace, although he didn't think of it as an abolitionist song. And the tune may have been taken from an African tune he heard earlier. The truth is always more complex than the stories we tell. But the connection between anti-slavery and Amazing Grace was cemented by the fact that Harriet Beecher Stowe used it in her powerful abolitionist book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and had the character of Tom sing the song. And she added a verse that had been sung in African-American communities to another spiritual, and that's the verse that begins, "When we've been there 10,000 years." It was a song sung by Tom in the novel and became a song that was sung through many struggles since. It was sung in Cherokee by the Cherokee on the Trail of Tears. It was sung by many, particularly Mahalia Jackson, in the civil rights struggle. It was sung notably by President Obama after the shooting at Mother Emanuel. We may not always agree with its theology, but its place as a song of hope in the storm cannot be denied. Please rise and join in singing Amazing Grace. This reading is by the Reverend David Petit, who is part of the Department of Ministry at the Unitarian Universalist Association, or part of the ministerial formation process there. And it's titled Hidden History. The full article is online if you want to Google the whole thing. He writes, "Here in the North, we have inherited a powerful historical amnesia when it comes to the memory of slavery. Where I live in Massachusetts, we still worship the stories of the Sons of Liberty. We still teach the midnight ride of Paul Revere to our school kids. Every third Monday in April is Patriots Day, when we commemorate again that first shot fired on Lexington Green that was heard around the world. In Massachusetts, our license plates remind us that we are the spirit of America. We are the good guys. In 1754, the Crown requested that every city and town in Massachusetts report the number of slaves over the age of 16. 114 communities responded to the census. 109 recorded at least one slave. The town fathers of Boston dutifully recorded 989 slaves, representing nearly 9% of the population. 989 slaves in Boston? How come I had to discover this by accident? Within walking distance of where I work in downtown Boston, there are numerous buildings and sites that pay homage to Boston's storied colonial past. Every day on my way to work, I pass the Robert Gould Shaw 54th Regiment Memorial on Beacon Street. Directly across the street from the memorial is the Massachusetts State House, built on property once owned by John Hancock. We all know John Hancock, or do we? The plaque that mentions where his house once stood conveniently neglects that Hancock was also a slaveholder. Today, Bay Staters are very proud of our abolitionist past. We forget that in 1835, William Lloyd Garrison, editor of The Liberator, was nearly murdered by an angry mob on the streets of Boston. In the 1960s, in the name of urban renewal, the office where the newspaper was published fell unceremoniously to the wrecking ball. At the base of Beacon Hill in the Boston Public Gardens stands a statue of Charles Sumner, widely considered the most radical abolitionist in the United States Senate before the Civil War. In 1856, after Sumner was nearly caned to death in the Senate chambers by South Carolina Representative Preston Brooks, hundreds of people sent money to Brooks so he could buy a new cane. It is quite understandable that many Massachusetts citizens were outraged. Few, however, questioned Sumner's outlandish claim made 2 years before that, when he thundered on the Senate floor, that no person was ever born a slave on the soil of Massachusetts. I can still remember vividly the first time I recovered the forgotten story of slavery in my own family. In 2006, I innocently upgraded my Ancestry.com subscription and was stunned to find the 1774 Rhode Island census that indicated that my ancestor, Edward Simmons, owned four slaves in Newport, Rhode Island. I drove to Newport the following day to get to the bottom of what was obviously some mistake. It wasn't. Instead, I found 11 more Newport ancestors who enslaved Africans. So much for slavery as a Southern institution. Thus ends the reading. This month, we share our monthly offering with Black Lives UU. More about them can be found in your order of service, but Black Lives UU is an organization dedicated to supporting and sustaining African Americans within our movement and to furthering the work of racial justice. And for the good work of that organization and for the work of this church, we will now take the morning offering.
Today's sermon is a very personal one for me. It's a personal story of family history and heritage, of struggle, of guilt, of dealing with, grappling with legacy and what that means. So I thought I'd come down here and just talk about it because it makes me a little nervous to talk about still, even though I've done so many times before. And also because I wanted to show off our fancy new device we have here at the church. It's our first ever lapel microphone. And I'm thrilled to have it. So, my great-great-great-grandfather was Jephthah Landrum. Jephthah Landrum was part of a militia in Fayette County, Georgia, where he did the work of driving the Creek and other Native Americans off of that land in Fayette County, Georgia. And after that was completed, they held a lottery for that land, a land grant lottery, and my ancestor Jephthah received a bunch of land in that lottery. I don't know how much of it he got from the lottery and how much of it he purchased additionally over time, but in total, he eventually owned 3,000 acres of land in Fayette County, Georgia. 3,000 acres is a lot. It's pretty big. In comparison, the amount, Thomas Jefferson owned several different pieces of property, but the land he inherited from his father was 5,000 acres. On that land, in that 3,000 acres, my great-great-grandfather built a Methodist church because he converted to Methodism because his wife was a very religious Methodist woman, and so he became a Methodist as well. And also on it, he built a cotton mill, and the plaque for that cotton mill still exists today. I've never seen it, but I saw it online. And he also had a plantation. Not all of that land was developed, but a good portion, or some portion of it was, and on there he had enslaved people that he owned. In the 1830 census, he had 8 slaves. By 1840, he had 10. In 1850, he still had 10. And by 1860, the family owned 13 or 15 slaves. His son was Larkin Lafayette, or in Georgia we say Lafayette, Larkin Lafayette Landrum Sr. And Larkin, he continued to own slaves, but it was during his time that the Civil War happened, and he spent a lot of work trying to keep the family properties together and fighting in the courts to retain as much land and wealth as he could. The family lost most of their wealth, but they retained most of their land. We're not sure exactly how many acres were retained by Larkin, and it's what he retained. Some of it may have been sold, some of it was divided among his children. And my great-grandfather, Larkin Lafayette Landrum Jr., inherited 50 acres of plantation land in Fayette County, Georgia. Larkin Lafayette Landrum Jr. Lived on the house on that land still. There was a small farmhouse built there, and he lived there. He became a Methodist preacher and preached itinerantly around Georgia and spread the gospel. And his son, Pierce Lafayette Landrum, my grandfather, still remembered his great-great-grandfather, Larkin Sr. And my grandfather Pierce lived on that property as well for a good portion of his childhood. Pierce was a farmer and a school teacher, and he inherited, when Larkin Jr. subdivided the land among his descendants, my grandfather Pierce inherited 9 acres of plantation land. He split that evenly between my father, William Lafayette Landrum, and my Aunt Jean. And Aunt Jean and most other relatives at this point, a lot of them sold off their land. My dad is one of only 2 Landrum relatives, descendants, who still own land. He may be the only one now. Last I checked, it was 2. And he owns 4.5 acres of plantation land in Fayette County, Georgia. I've been there. I visited it. It has the skeletal remains of that old farmhouse and a lot of beer cans from hunters who've gone in there and poached on the land. And it's undeveloped woods. We've never made any money from it since in the last couple generations, except that my grandfather allowed them to come through and cut some trees down for cash at one point. But my father, he just pays taxes on it every year and has had a couple offers to sell it. And after discussion with his children, and particularly at my encouragement, has kept the land. Why did I do that? Because I'm still wrestling with what it means. I have been wrestling ever since I learned this. I didn't grow up knowing we had slaves in the family. Because we didn't talk about it. Nobody in Georgia talks about it. It wasn't a secret. It wasn't in the closet. It was just not something talked about. And so I was an adult before I learned that, and then started grappling with, what does it mean, this family land that I've heard about all my life, the land I had heard about all my life, the family Bible I had heard about all my life. That family Bible records my direct ancestors. It also includes some of the slave names, some of whom are undoubtedly my relatives as well. This land is their heritage, too, but it didn't get passed down their ancestry line, just mine. So someday, if my father doesn't sell it first, I stand to inherit 1.5 acres of plantation land on which my ancestors enslaved others. I think we all struggle with the legacy of white supremacy. Are we all who have white skin, I should say, because not all of us do, struggle with what that means. But not everybody has such a tangible history like mine. And many people's lives and ancestries are much more complex than mine. Many people carry within them both oppressor and oppressed. When you look at my family history, it's pretty unambiguous. When you look at my family's DNA history, my dad's DNA says, I look at my mom's, it's a little bit more complex. But when you pull up my dad's, it says 100% white. You know, trace elements other. 100%. And Western European and British Isles. So, that's my legacy. And while you could say I haven't really gained anything from owning this land, because we just pay taxes on it. That's all it's done for the last several decades, is take tax money from us. But there are ways in which I can look, knowing this, and see that the legacy of being slave owners did impact my family and does continue to impact me. Because, you see, my family were dirt poor farmers. Dirt poor farmers with college degrees. Dirt poor farmers in rural Georgia who had class standing in their communities. That's part of that legacy of being that upper crust at one point of Georgia society. Now, when I first started preaching this and talking about this, it was like 1998, 1999, Tandeka, who is an African-American UU scholar, had just come out with a paper about why everything we were doing in our movement about anti-racism is wrong. Because at that time, anti-racism in our movement was about understanding for white people that we all carry within us racism. It was about owning our racism. And for Tandeka, she argued that most white people didn't own slaves. Only 6% or something did. And it's really about classism. This was an economic system of oppression. I don't disagree with that, but I think there's something more. And I think we've learned a lot in the years since. Around that time, Edward Ball wrote a book about slaves and the family. And in it, he says something to the effect of, there was a joke in our family about several things you don't talk about. It was money, politics, religion, and the slaves. He used another word. But since those days when I first started talking about it, in our movement of Unitarian Universalism, we've changed a lot in our anti-racism work. Since that time period, we've seen the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement. We've seen how this legacy that we talked about earlier in the service about lynching continues through the violence that continues to be perpetuated against black bodies. And I think we understand differently that history, while it may not be an original sin that I was born with, that history does carry with it a certain privilege. Now, you could say it's not really the ancestry. My African-American land and relatives have that same heritage, that same ancestry, but they didn't carry with them the other forms of privilege that I got that came with that white skin, the family name, the lineage of being recognized through marriage and birth of our family history. So it's much more complex than just ancestry. But there is still something to saying, as the Lakota do, that I am all my relatives. Or the Mormons who believe that you can save your ancestors and that it's important to do so. And part of the steps for that is the genealogical research that they do. Or as it says in our hymn that's in your teal hymnal that was sung at our 9 a.m. service, we are our grandmother's dreaming. We are our grandfather's prayers. We are the breath of our ancestors. We are the breath of our ancestors. So I believe that not everyone has as unambiguous a case as I do. You don't all have 1.5 acres of land. But and some of you have a very different story of not having had white skin privilege and other forms of privilege that I have. But for many of us, for some of us, we do have, whether it's literal or symbolic, we have 1.5 acres of land that we carry. And then the question becomes, so what? What do we do? What do we do literally when we have this legacy of privilege? Do I sell it off and divide it amongst everyone I can find who's an ancestor? Or give it just to my African-American cousins? Do I make a memorial there? Do I hand it over to the state? Do I continue to pay taxes on it and pass it down for my child to remember? I don't know the answer yet. All sorts of answers have their merit. But I do know that I am called because of my ancestry. I am called because of who I am to do work for justice. That my 1.5 acres of land compels me to do this work in the world. Be an advocate, to be an ally, to do the work of racial justice, to keep preaching, keep talking about this, and to slowly change the world. It's all I know for sure. It's all I can do. But I believe that we in our faith are called to do it together. Because we also inherit, if not literally, then spiritually, figuratively, we inherit good and bad from our ancestors. In our faith, we inherit this wonderful building that our forefathers, foremothers, foreparents built. With that comes the triumphant spirit of Unitarianism that believed in covenantal communities. With it comes the universalist spirit that believed in the inherent worth and dignity of all people. With it comes the transcendentalist spirit that God can be found everywhere. With it also comes that legacy of Massachusetts we talked about in the reading. With it also comes the way in which our spiritual heritage was built on the backs of people, whether directly or indirectly, that this country stood for. As a living piece of history, our faith, our living tradition, calls us to always work towards the greater good. And it will be hard, we know. And the road will be muddy and rough. But we will get there. Heaven knows how we will get there. But we know we will. Please join us again. May we go in peace, carrying forth the light of our heritage and the complexity of our lives to bring justice and peace to this world until we are together again. Amen.